She braced her feet for an instant to resist. But his mouth was pressed to hers, and they went down to the ground together, never breaking their lips apart. She lay still, as the motionless, then the quivering object of an act which he did simply, unhesitatingly, as of right. The right of the unendurable pleasure it gave them. He named what it meant to both of them in the first words he spoke afterwards. He said, "We had to learn it from each other." She looked at his long figure stretched on the grass beside her. He wore black slacks and a black shirt. Her eyes stopped on the belt, pulled tight across his slender waistline, and she felt the stab of an emotion that was like a gasp of pride, pride in her ownership of his body. She lay on her back looking up at the sky, feeling no desire to move or think or know that there was any time beyond this moment. When she came home, when she lay in bed, naked because her body had become an unfamiliar possession, too precious for the touch of a nightgown, because it gave her pleasure to feel naked and to feel as if the white sheets of her bed were touched by Francisco's body. When she thought that she would not sleep, because she did not want to rest and lose the most wonderful exhaustion she had ever known. Her last thought was of the times when she had wanted to express, but found no way to do it, an instant's knowledge of a feeling greater than happiness, the feeling of one's blessing upon the whole of the earth, the feeling of being in love with the fact that one exists and in this kind of world. She thought that the act she had learned was the way one expressed it. If this was a thought of the gravest importance, she did not know it. Nothing could be grave in a universe from which the concept of pain had been wiped out. She was not there to weigh her conclusion. She was asleep, a faint smile on her face, in a silent, luminous room filled with the light of morning. That summer she met him in the woods, in hidden corners by the river, on the floor of an abandoned shack, in the cellar of the house. These were the only times when she learned to feel a sense of beauty, by looking up at old wooden rafters or at the steel plate of an air-conditioning machine that whirred tensely, rhythmically above their heads. She wore slacks or cotton summer dresses, yet she was never so feminine as when she stood beside him, sagging in his arms, abandoning herself to anything he wished, in open acknowledgment of his power to reduce her to helplessness by the pleasure he had the power to give her. He taught her every manner of sensuality he could invent. "Isn't it wonderful that our bodies can give us so much pleasure?" he said to her once, quite simply. They were happy and radiantly innocent. They were both incapable of the conception that joy is sin. They kept their secret from the knowledge of others, not as a shameful guilt, but as a thing that was immaculately theirs, beyond anyone's right of debate or appraisal. She knew the general doctrine on sex, held by people in one form or another, the doctrine that sex was an ugly weakness of man's lower nature, to be condoned regretfully. She experienced an emotion of chastity that made her shrink, not from the desires of her body, but from any contact with the minds who held this doctrine. That winter, Francisco came to see her in New York at unpredictable intervals. He would fly down from Cleveland without warning twice a week, or he would vanish for months. She would sit on the floor of her room, surrounded by charts and blueprints. She would hear a knock at her door and snap, "I'm busy," then hear a mocking voice ask, "Are you?" and leap to her feet to throw the door open to find him standing there. They would go to an apartment he had rented in the city, a small apartment in a quiet neighborhood. "Francisco," she asked him once, in sudden astonishment, "I'm your mistress, am I not?" He laughed. "That's what you are." She felt the pride a woman is supposed to experience at being granted the title of wife. In the many months of his absence, she never wondered whether he was true to her or not. She knew he was. She knew, even though she was too young to know the reason, that indiscriminate desire and unselective indulgence were possible only to those who regarded sex and themselves as evil. She knew little about Francisco's life. It was his last year in college. He seldom spoke of it, and she never questioned him. She suspected that he was working too hard, because she saw at times the unnaturally bright look of his face, the look of exhilaration that comes from driving one's energy beyond its limit. She laughed at him once, boasting that she was an old employee of Taggart Transcontinental, while he had not started to work for a living. He said, "My father refuses to let me work for Dunconia Copper until I graduate." "When did you learn to be obedient?" "I must respect his wishes. He is the owner of Dunconia Copper." "He is not, however, the owner of all the copper companies in the world." There was a hint of secret amusement in his smile. She did not learn the story until the next fall, when he had graduated and returned to New York after a visit to his father in Buenos Aires. Then he told her that he had taken two courses of education during the last 4 years, one at the Patrick Henry University, the other in a copper foundry on the outskirts of Cleveland. "I like to learn things for myself," he said. He had started working at the foundry as a furnace boy when he was 16, and now at 20, he owned it. He acquired his first title of property, with the aid of some inaccuracy about his age, on the day when he received his university diploma, and he sent them both to his father. He showed her a photograph of the foundry. It was a small, grimy place, disreputable with age, battered by years of a losing struggle. Above its entrance gate, like a new flag on the mast of a derelict, hung the sign, "Dunconia Copper." The public relations man of his father's office in New York had moaned, outraged, "But Don Francisco, you can't do that. What will the public think? That name, on a dump of this kind?" "It's my name," Francisco had answered. When he entered his father's office in Buenos Aires, a large room, severe and modern as a laboratory, with photographs of the properties of Dunconia Copper as sole ornament on its walls, photographs of the greatest mines, ore docks, and foundries in the world, he saw, in the place of honor facing his father's desk, a photograph of the Cleveland foundry, with the new sign above its gate. His father's eyes moved from the photograph to Francisco's face as he stood in front of the desk. "Isn't it a little too soon?" his father asked. "I couldn't have stood 4 years of nothing but lectures. Where did you get the money for your first payment on that property?" "By playing the New York stock market." "What? Who taught you to do that?" "It is not difficult to judge which industrial ventures will succeed and which won't." "Where did you get the money to play with?" "From the allowance you sent me, sir, and from my wages." "When did you have time to watch the stock market?" "While I was writing a thesis on the influence, upon subsequent metaphysical systems, of Aristotle's theory of the immovable mover." Francisco's stay in New York was brief that fall. His father was sending him to Montana as assistant superintendent of a Dunconia mine. "Oh, well," he said to Dagny, smiling, "my father does not think it advisable to let me rise too fast. I would not ask him to take me on faith. If he wants a factual demonstration, I shall comply." In the spring, Francisco came back as head of the New York office of Dunconia Copper. She did not see him often in the next 2 years. She never knew where he was, in what city or on what continent, the day after she had seen him. He always came to her unexpectedly, and she liked it, because it made him a continuous presence in her life, like the ray of a hidden light that could hit her at any moment. Whenever she saw him in his office, she thought of his hands as she had seen them on the wheel of a motorboat. He drove his business with the same smooth, dangerous, confidently mastered speed. But one small incident remained in her mind as a shock. It did not fit him. She saw him standing at the window of his office one evening, looking at the brown winter twilight of the city. He did not move for a long time. His face was hard and tight. It had the look of an emotion she had never believed possible to him, of bitter, helpless anger. He said, "There's something wrong in the world. There's always been. Something no one has ever named or explained." He would not tell her what it was. When she saw him again, no trace of that incident remained in his manner. It was spring, and they stood together on the roof terrace of a restaurant, the light silk of her evening gown blowing in the wind against his tall figure in formal black clothes. They looked at the city. In the dining room behind them, the sounds of the music were a concert etude by Richard Halley. Halley's name was not known to many, but they had discovered it, and they loved his music. Francisco said, We don't have to look for skyscrapers in the distance, do we? We've reached them. She smiled and said, I think we're going past them. I'm almost afraid. We're on a speeding elevator of some kind. Sure, afraid of what? Let it speed. Why should there be a limit? He was 23 when his father died, and he went to Buenos Aires to take over the Danconia estate, now his. She did not see him again for 3 years. He wrote to her, at first at random intervals. He wrote about Danconia Copper, about the world market, about issues affecting the interests of Taggart Transcontinental. His letters were brief, written by hand, usually at night. She was not unhappy in his absence. She, too, was making her first steps toward the control of a future kingdom. Among the leaders of industry, her father's friends, she heard it said that one had better watch the young Danconia heir. If that copper company had been great before, it would sweep the world now under what his management promised to become. She smiled without astonishment. There were moments when she felt a sudden violent longing for him, but it was only impatience, not pain. She dismissed it in the confident knowledge that they were both working toward a future that would bring them everything they wanted, including each other. Then, his letters stopped. She was 24 on that day of spring when the telephone rang on her desk in an office of the Taggart building. Dagny, said a voice she recognized at once. I'm at the Wayne Falkland. Come to have dinner with me tonight at 7. He said it without greeting, as if they had parted the day before. Because it took her a moment to regain the art of breathing, she realized for the first time how much that voice meant to her. All right, Francisco, she answered. They needed to say nothing else. She thought, replacing the receiver, that his return was natural, and as she had always expected it to happen, except that she had not expected her sudden need to pronounce his name, or the stab of happiness she felt while pronouncing it. When she entered his hotel room that evening, she stopped short. He stood in the middle of the room looking at her, and she saw a smile that came slowly, involuntarily, as if he had lost the ability to smile and were astonished that he should regain it. He looked at her incredulously, not quite believing what she was or what he felt. His glance was like a plea, like the cry for help of a man who could never cry. At her entrance, he had started their old salute. He had started to say, Hi, but he did not finish it. Instead, after a moment, he said, You're beautiful, Dagny. He said it as if it hurt him. Francisco, I... He shook his head, not to let her pronounce the words they had never said to each other, even though they knew that both had said and heard them in that moment. He approached. He took her in his arms. He kissed her mouth and held her for a long time. When she looked up at his face, he was smiling down at her confidently, derisively. It was a smile that told her he was in control of himself, of her, of everything, and ordered her to forget what she had seen in that first moment. Hi, slug, he said. Feeling certain of nothing, except that she must not ask questions, she smiled and said, Hi, Frisco. She could have understood any change, but not the things she saw. There was no sparkle of life in his face, no hint of amusement. The face had become implacable. The plea of his first smile had not been a plea of weakness. He had acquired an air of determination that seemed merciless. He acted like a man who stood straight under the weight of an unendurable burden. She saw what she could not have believed possible, that there were lines of bitterness in his face, and that he looked tortured. Dagny, don't be astonished by anything I do, he said, or by anything I may ever do in the future. That was the only explanation he granted her, then proceeded to act as if there were nothing to explain. She could feel no more than a faint anxiety. It was impossible to feel fear for his fate or in his presence. When he laughed, she thought they were back in the woods by the Hudson. He had not changed, and never would. The dinner was served in his room. She found it amusing to face him across a table laid out with the icy formality pertaining to excessive cost, in a hotel room designed as a European palace. The Wayne Falkland was the most distinguished hotel left on any continent. Its style of indolent luxury, of velvet drapes, sculptured panels, and candlelight, seemed a deliberate contrast to its function. No one could afford its hospitality except men who came to New York on business to settle transactions involving the world. She noticed that the manner of the waiters who served their dinner suggested a special deference to this particular guest of the hotel, and that Francisco did not notice it. He was indifferently at home. He had long since become accustomed to the fact that he was Señor Danconia of Danconia Copper. But she thought it strange that he did not speak about his work. She had expected it to be his only interest, the first thing he would share with her. He did not mention it. He led her to talk instead about her job, her progress, and what she felt for Taggart Transcontinental. She spoke of it as she had always spoken to him, in the knowledge that he was the only one who could understand her passionate devotion. He made no comment, but he listened intently. A waiter had turned on the radio for dinner music. They had paid no attention to it. But suddenly a crash of sound jarred the room, almost as if a subterranean blast had struck the walls and made them tremble. The shock came not from the loudness, but from the quality of the sounds. It was Halley's new concerto, recently written, the fourth. They sat in silence, listening to the statement of rebellion, the anthem of the triumph of the great victims who would refuse to accept pain. Francisco listened, looking out at the city. Without transition or warning, he asked, his voice oddly unstressed, "Dagny, what would you say if I asked you to leave Taggart Transcontinental and let it go to hell, as it will when your brother takes over?" "What would I say if you asked me to consider the idea of committing suicide?" she answered angrily. He remained silent. "Why did you say that?" she snapped. "I didn't think you'd joke about it. It's not like you." There was no touch of humor in his face. He answered quietly, gravely, "No, of course, I shouldn't." She brought herself to question him about his work. He answered the questions. He volunteered nothing. She repeated to him the comments of the industrialists about the brilliant prospects of Danconia Copper under his management. "That's true," he said, his voice lifeless. In sudden anxiety, not knowing what prompted her, she asked, "Francisco, why did you come to New York?" He answered slowly, "To see a friend who called for me." "Business?" Looking past her, as if answering a thought of his own, a faint smile of bitter amusement on his face, but his voice, strangely soft and sad, he answered, "Yes." It was long past midnight when she awakened in bed by his side. No sounds came from the city below. The stillness of the room made life seem suspended for a while. Relaxed in happiness and in complete exhaustion, she turned lazily to glance at him. He lay on his back, half propped by a pillow. She saw his profile against the foggy glow of the night sky in the window. He was awake. His eyes were open. He held his mouth closed, like a man lying in resignation, in unbearable pain, bearing it, making no attempt to hide it. She was too frightened to move. He felt her glance and turned to her. He shuddered suddenly. He threw off the blanket. He looked at her naked body. Then he fell forward and buried his face between her breasts. He held her shoulders, hanging on to her convulsively. She heard the words muffled, his mouth pressed to her skin. "I can't give it up. I can't." "What?" she whispered.
"You."
"Why should?"
"And everything."
"Why should you give it up?"
"Dagny, help me to remain, to refuse, even though he's right."
She asked evenly, "To refuse what, Francisco?" He did not answer, only pressed his face harder against her. She lay very still, conscious of nothing but a supreme need of caution. His head on her breast, her hand caressing his hair gently, steadily, She lay looking up at the ceiling of the room at the sculptured garlands, faintly visible in the darkness, and she waited, numb with terror. He moaned, "It's right, but it's so hard to do. Oh, God, it's so hard." After a while, he raised his head. He sat up. He had stopped trembling. "What is it, Francisco?"
"I can't tell you."
His voice was simple, open, without attempt to disguise suffering, but it was a voice that obeyed him now.
"You're not ready to hear it."
"I want to help you."
"You can't."
"You said to help you refuse."
"I can't refuse."
"Then let me share it with you."
He shook his head.
He sat looking down at her as if weighing a question. Then he shook his head again in answer to himself.
"If I'm not sure I can stand it," he said,
and the strange new note in his voice was tenderness.
"How could you?"
She said slowly, with effort, trying to keep herself from screaming, "Francisco, I have to know.
Will you forgive me?
I know you're frightened, and it's cruel. But will you do this for me?
Will you let it go?
Just let it go and don't ask me anything?
That's all you can do for me.
Will you?"
"Yes, Francisco."
"Don't be afraid for me. It was just this once. It won't happen to me again. It will become much easier later."
"If I could..."
"No. Go to sleep, dearest." It was the first time he had ever used that word. In the morning, he faced her openly, not avoiding her anxious glance, but saying nothing about it. She saw both serenity and suffering in the calm of his face, an expression like a smile of pain, though he was not smiling. Strangely, it made him look younger. He did not look like a man bearing torture now, but like a man who sees that which makes the torture worth bearing. She did not question him. Before leaving, she asked only, "When will I see you again?" He answered, "I don't know. Don't wait for me, Dagny. Next time we meet, you will not want to see me. I will have a reason for the things I'll do, but I can't tell you the reason, and you will be right to damn me. I am not committing the contemptible act of asking you to take me on faith. You have to live by your own knowledge and judgment. You will damn me. You will be hurt. Try not to let it hurt you too much. Remember that I told you this, and that it was all I could tell you." She heard nothing from him or about him for a year. When she began to hear gossip and to read newspaper stories, she did not believe at first that they referred to Francisco d'Ancona. After a while, she had to believe it. She read the story of the party he gave on his yacht in the harbor of Valparaiso. The guests wore bathing suits, and an artificial rain of champagne and flower petals kept falling upon the decks throughout the night. She read the story of the party he gave at an Algerian desert resort. He built a pavilion of thin sheets of ice and presented every woman guest with an ermine wrap, as a gift to be worn for the occasion, on condition that they remove their wraps, then their evening gowns, then all the rest, in tempo with the melting of the walls. She read the accounts of the business ventures he undertook at lengthy intervals. The ventures were spectacularly successful and ruined his competitors, but he indulged in them as in an occasional sport, staging a sudden raid, then vanishing from the industrial scene for a year or two, leaving D'Ancona a copper to the management of his employees. She read the interview where he said, "Why should I wish to make money? I have enough to permit 3 generations of descendants to have as good a time as I'm having." She saw him once, at a reception given by an ambassador in New York. He bowed to her courteously, he smiled, and he looked at her with a glance in which no past existed. She drew him aside. She said only, "Francisco, why?"
"Why what?"
he asked. She turned away.
"I warned you," he said.
She did not try to see him again. She survived it. She was able to survive it because she did not believe in suffering. She faced with astonished indignation the ugly fact of feeling pain and refused to let it matter. suffering was a senseless accident. It was not part of life as she saw it. She would not allow pain to become important. She had no name for the kind of resistance she offered, for the emotion from which the resistance came. But the words that stood as its equivalent in her mind were, "It does not count. It is not to be taken seriously." She knew these were the words, even in the moments when there was nothing left within her but screaming, and she wished she could lose the faculty of consciousness so that it would not tell her that what could not be true was true. Not to be taken seriously, an immovable certainty within her kept repeating, "Pain and ugliness are never to be taken seriously." She fought it. She recovered. Years helped her to reach the day when she could face her memories indifferently. Then the day when she felt no necessity to face them. It was finished, and of no concern to her any longer. There had been no other men in her life. She did not know whether this had made her unhappy. She had had no time to know. She found the clean, brilliant sense of life as she wanted it in her work. Once Francisco had given her the same sense, a feeling that belonged with her work and in her world. The men she had met since were like the men she met at her first ball. She had won the battle against her memories, but one form of torture remained, untouched by the years, the torture of the word, "Why?" Whatever the tragedy he met, why had Francisco taken the ugliest way of escape, as ignoble as the way of some cheap alcoholic? The boy she had known could not have become a useless coward. An incomparable mind could not turn its ingenuity to the invention of melting ballrooms. Yet he had, and did, and there was no explanation to make it conceivable, and to let her forget him in peace. She could not doubt the fact of what he had been. She could not doubt the fact of what he had become. Yet one made the other impossible. At times she almost doubted her own rationality, or the existence of any rationality anywhere. But this was a doubt which she did not permit to anyone. Yet there was no explanation, no reason, no clue to any conceivable reason, and in all the days of 10 years she had found no hint of an answer. No, she thought, as she walked through the gray twilight past the windows of abandoned shops to the Wayne Falkland Hotel. No, there could be no answer. She would not seek it. It did not matter now. The remnant of violence, the emotion rising as a thin trembling within her, was not for the man she was going to see. It was a cry of protest against a sacrilege, against the destruction of what had been greatness. In a break between buildings, she saw the towers of the Wayne Falkland. She felt a slight jolt in her lungs and legs that stopped her for an instant. Then she walked on evenly. By the time she walked through the marble lobby to the elevator, then down the wide velvet-carpeted soundless corridors of the Wayne Falkland, she felt nothing but a cold anger that grew colder with every step. She was certain of the anger when she knocked at his door. She heard his voice answering, "Come in." She jerked the door open and entered. Francisco Domingo Carlos Andrés Sebastián D'Anconia sat on the floor playing marbles. Nobody ever wondered whether Francisco D'Anconia was good-looking or not. It seemed irrelevant. When he entered a room, it was impossible to look at anyone else. His tall, slender figure had an air of distinction, too authentic to be modern, and he moved as if he had a cape floating behind him in the wind. People explained him by saying that he had the vitality of a healthy animal, but they knew dimly that that was not correct. He had the vitality of a healthy human being, a thing so rare that no one could identify it. He had the power of certainty. Nobody described his appearance as Latin, yet the word applied to him, not in its present, but in its original sense, not pertaining to Spain, but to ancient Rome. His body seemed designed as an exercise in consistency of style, a style made of gauntness, of tight flesh, long legs, and swift movements. His features had the fine precision of sculpture. His hair was black and straight, swept back. The suntan of his skin intensified the startling color of his eyes. They were a pure, clear blue. His face was open, its rapid changes of expression reflecting whatever he felt, as if he had nothing to hide. The blue eyes were still and changeless, never giving a hint of what he thought.